This is Tax Update for Saturday, March the 18th, 2006. The Tax Update podcast is intended for tax professionals and is not designed for those not skilled in independent tax research. All readers and listeners are expected to do their own research to confirm items raised in this presentation before relying upon the positions presented. The podcast and the document may be reproduced freely so long as no fee is charged for the use of the document or the podcast. Such prohibited use would include using this podcast or document as part of a CP presentation for which a fee is charged. The podcast this week is being sponsored by Limeburg Information Services, located on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. Limeburg Information Services offers email newsletters on tax-related matters, as well as access to a library of useful tax information to tax practitioners who are the subscribers to the service. You can find out more information about subscribing to their service at www.limeburgservices.com. This week, now that we're past the income tax filing deadline for corporations, for those calendar year corporations you had in tow, we're going to take a look this week at maybe a slightly different topic, go off the income tax road for a little distance, and this week talk about payroll taxes, and specifically the potential liabilities that clients come into with things that happen regarding payroll taxes, both the trust fund recovery penalty and the problem of what happens if your payroll service doesn't pay the payroll taxes. And we bring this up because this week we saw two cases come down that dealt with this area. So we'll deal with those in time and look at this. Let's first deal with the general rule. We all know that generally as an employer, we're required to withhold taxes from our employees and then send those taxes on to the government. Now, these funds are called trust funds in the theory that you are holding them as the employer, not as your own money anymore, but rather they are payments from the employee that you have been entrusted to deliver to the proper government agency, that is the IRS. Therefore, these funds are considered essentially not yours, and there are special rules and regulations that deal with them. As you may or may not be aware, if an employee ends up with a W-2 with a withholding on it, the taxes were taken out, even if the employer did not end up making the payment, the employee is still going to get the benefit of those withheld taxes when they file their 1040. The issue then becomes, since the government will seem to be out, and the government does not hold the employee responsible, the government does hold the employer responsible for getting those funds in. Given that situation, we have some rather nasty situations that can arise when those funds are not put in, because there are penalties here that reach outside of the corporate or the entity setting and can go after individuals even with no ownership interest in the entity. Specifically, we're talking about the trust fund recovery penalty found in Section 6672A of the Internal Revenue Code. That provision reads, any person required to collect, truthfully account for, and pay over any tax imposed by this title who willfully fails to collect such tax or truthfully account for and pay over such tax, or willfully attempts in any manner to evade or defeat any such tax or the payment thereof, shall, in addition to other penalties provided by law, be liable to a penalty equal to the total amount of the tax evaded or not collected or not accounted for and paid over. This is what's known as the trust fund recovery penalty, although as you can see, it's actually a bit broader than that. But our area of concern is what happens when an employer withholds taxes from the employee's wages, but then, perhaps because they're in a bit of a financial bind, ends up not paying those taxes to the IRS, instead pays the supplier so that they can keep in business for next week, pays the rent so they're not kicked out of their building. In those situations, the liability is not just limited to the employer. The problem becomes now being a responsible person. If you're a responsible person and you allowed the company to pay somebody else rather than the IRS for the trust fund liability, you now can be fully liable on the taxes withheld. In a recent case decided in the United States District Court for the Eastern District of California, Savage versus the United States, The court looked at this issue, and in fact, in this case, the court dealt with the question of what happens when we have an owner who had been somewhat apart from the business, hadn't really been involved in detail, had left things up to his bookkeeper and supposedly to the payroll service to make sure the payroll taxes were being paid, discovers down the line that, in addition to all of his other financial problems, the payroll taxes weren't paid. At what point did he become a responsible party, and at what point does he pick up liability? In the Savage case, we had an owner here, the president and chief executive officer, from 1974 through December 1998. This was the gentleman, David Savage. He had health problems. He resigned his position. John Allison took over as chairman and assumed responsibility for the finances. Now, he had a number of health problems. They were not resolved. He suffered a heart attack in 1999, an angina attack in 2000. He undertook an intensive diet program that helped him trim down by September 2001. During this time, he was basically absent from the business, didn't really participate in day-to-day management. However, during that period, he did retain the right to send checks and occasionally exercise his power, even though he's only marginally involved in the business. So he signed a few checks over this time period when he had his health problems and he was out of the business. Now, while he was gone, the company struggled mightily during that period. He learned in March of 2001 that the company had suffered a large net operating loss for the year 2000. He also learned at some point that his new CFO had failed to pay the payroll taxes for the last two quarters of 1998 and the first three quarters of 1999. Eventually, she resolved those problems, but began to miss payroll tax payments again, beginning with the third quarter of 2000 through the end of 2001. Now, that's the fact pattern we're looking at. He received multiple notices regarding the second round of taxes. However, Phyllis assured him the taxes had actually been paid. Her accounting books and records that showed the taxes were paid were reviewed by the CPA. And she provided a letter purportedly from the IRS, but later found to be a forgery, stating that the taxes were fully paid. So his CFO lied to him. In August of 2001, he resumed control of the business and noted due to the continuing losses, he decided it was time to shut down the business. As part of the process, in December of 2001, he learned that Paychex, the payroll company, had stopped making federal tax deposits, quote unquote, in September because the company had had insufficient funds. Now, note, it's important to note here that he learned it was in September, apparently didn't find out which year. This would be crucial. Between August of 2001 and January 9th of 2002, he loaned the company $230,000 of his personal funds to pay off the existing debt. Two days after the final loan, after a visit from a revenue officer, he realized that the delinquent payroll taxes dated all the way back to September of 2000, not 2001. The Paychex letter was from a 2000 period. And he basically had mistakenly believed that wasn't the case. Now, everything up to here appeared to be maybe not fine, but at least it was going to be a more difficult case for the government. However, shortly after the discussion with the revenue officer, he's now aware there's a shortfall, he repaid himself $70,000 of the money that he had loaned the company. In essence, he had advanced the company $230,000. Now it was going to be clear that that extra $70,000 was not going to go toward the debts he thought it was going to go towards, but rather would have to go to the government. As such, he pulled the $70,000 back out, deciding that he would not have done, you know, was not going to advance enough to pay the government plus the other creditors. Therefore, some people just weren't going to get paid, is apparently the way he decided it was going to have to work. The problem was, now the government comes in and asserts the trust fund penalty. What's the problem? He was a creditor, and he was paid in preference to the government. and he was paid in preference to the government after Mr. Savage became aware that there was a tax liability outstanding. This presents us with a problem. Now, the court goes on and does the analysis for responsible person and makes clear that the issue here is willfully failed to comply. And his claim was that he was not a responsible person and he did not exercise willful authority. He's not a willful offender. Now, the court pretty quickly decided that his authority exceeded mere nominal authority, that he basically was in a position to make some changes and control things, and therefore he clearly was in a position to do it. The question turned to, was it willful? Now, as he said, there's a lot of questions prior to that repayment. And they note this, the court does quickly. However, the court note these arguments were not material to his willfulness, all the medical problems and all the other issues that had him removed from the business after January 11, 2002. Given that the plaintiff was undisputably aware of the unpaid employment taxes on that day. Significantly, then, the court goes on, despite this knowledge, plaintiff, who had personally loaned the corporation $230,000, repaid himself $70,000 after he became aware that PCI had tax problems. Through this act, plaintiff consciously and intentionally preferred himself as a creditor over the United States. The court makes clear this is the smoking gun. Once we know he did this, we now have the willful act. And as noted, once this happened, factual issues prior to that knowledge become irrelevant. At this point, he knew there was a problem, he knew there was a debt owed to the government, and he took the steps to pay someone else at this point. In essence, regardless of whether he might not have been a responsible person and might not have been personally on the hook for the payroll taxes prior to the date he found out from the revenue officer that the taxes were owed and then repaid himself, once he repaid someone else other than the government from the funds of the company, he became a responsible person and everything, and he just inherited those taxes. By the way, the court also noted that the attorney for the plaintiff was arguing loudly that, well, if he's liable, he should only be liable for the $70,000 he took out, since that's all he really harmed the government by paying himself back. So he should have to put the $70,000 back, get us back to where we were, let the government take that, and all will be fine. Now, the court dealt with this and noted it's aware that some courts have limited a responsible person's liability, basically to the extent the corporation had funds available to pay the government when they first learned of it. And at this point, the only thing in the company was $70,000. However, the court noted that the Ninth Circuit in Davis, if the taxpayer has sufficient income to satisfy in full the deficiency, but basically, the court looked at that and said, essentially, once you've done and made a payment that preferred someone, you're on the hook for the whole thing, regardless of the fact that there wasn't enough there. So basically, you can't limit the liability to willfulness just based upon what was been available at the time of the willful act. Rather, he was liable for the whole balance due. And the court notes in from the Ninth Circuit's perspective and the court's perspective that to do so would be inconsistent with the language of the statute. Therefore, the court held he was liable for the entire balance. This raises some very nasty possibilities, since we're not quite sure at what point, once we have the willfulness, that our payment is going to trigger it. But it appears that once you're aware of the payroll taxes and you allow anything else to go out the door, you have just adopted the entire balance, even if, in fact, the corporation could not possibly have paid the taxes. There is no way you could have caused the corporation to pay the entire balance at that time. Therefore, it is very important that potentially responsible parties understand these rules and understand the trouble they can get into. Unfortunately, clients that get in financial trouble tend to think first and foremost of keeping the doors open. Unfortunately, the IRS doesn't usually show up the day after a late payroll tax deposit and put padlocks on the door. However, your landlord, your utility company, your suppliers do cut you off quicker and are more likely to come down and shut the business down for non-payment. Therefore, it is very, very tempting to take those funds and use them to pay the people who will shut you down tomorrow, as opposed to paying the IRS, who probably won't take action for months. What clients have to understand is once they start going down that path, they are now personally liable for the entire unpaid payroll taxes. And this is a major problem. As well, anyone in the company who is potentially responsible and has authority needs to understand that they can end up taking over responsibility for these taxes if they go along with or cause somebody to be paid before the government. As I've told people before who face this situation who are accountants or bookkeepers, there comes a point at which you must simply resign and walk out the door. You must give up the job. Keeping that job to get the paycheck next week could be incredibly expensive in the longer term when the company fails and the payroll taxes are never paid. It is important that anyone in the bookkeeping arena or in the accounting arena who is a controller or in those positions understand that these rules are serious and that essentially there comes a point at which you give up the job rather than allow somebody to be paid in advance of the IRS. Your job will be gone, most likely. I hate to tell them this, but quite often do. You look at the finances and figure it's a matter of time before your job's gone. And the question is, are you going to get out of this with no paycheck and a huge debt owed to the government? Or are you going to get out of it just with no paycheck and the right to go on somewhere else and not have this debt over you? The second case we're going to look at this week arose kind of indirectly because the IRS and the Social Security Administration in this month's Social Security Administration IRS Reporter, I suppose I say this quarter, had an article on page 4 of the Reporter that dealt with an employer's responsibility when they outsource payroll. Now, this is important because we've seen a number of cases, and in fact, we saw one just recently that came down, where payroll companies have failed to pay the payroll tax deposits. They have taken the money from the employer, but when time came to deposit the money with the government, they failed to do so. And unfortunately, the employer will still be held liable in those cases. This week, we'll consider the case of Pediatrics Affiliates versus United States. Now, this case came from the United States District Court in New Jersey. And what happened under this case was, of course, basically, the payroll service that Pediatrics Affiliates had hired embezzled from them. They took the money, they took the amounts that were to be used to pay payroll taxes, they pulled them out of Pediatrics Affiliates' accounts, and then didn't pay the government. The owner of the payroll service basically embezzled the payments that Pediatric and others of his clients made. Now, he would prepare and send to Pediatrics a tax form that reflected their actual liability. Pediatric would say, aha, I owe the tax. They transferred the money to the service. Now, he would then prepare a form that reflected an understated liability, and he sent that to the IRS, invested the difference between the amount he received from the Pediatrics and the amount he sent to the IRS in a personal hedge fund. Now, Pediatric received a notice from the IRS in 2002 that underpaid his payroll taxes in 1999 and 2000. Now, Pediatric reviewed its records and found it had no shortfall. Presumably, the IRS issued this notice because the W-2 amounts weren't going to line up. At some point, we got to tell the employees what they got, and the employees are probably going to catch on to this, so we need to do it correctly. Now, Pediatric said this is right. They figured there is no problem. The IRS sent second and third notices. Pediatrics kept saying there was no problem. And basically, The IRS finally sent Pediatrics documents that reflect a discrepancy that was not apparent based on information Pediatric had given, was given by the payroll service. Pediatrics contacted the owner of the payroll service and was told the payroll service owner had misappropriated the funds that they had been transferred to him. The payroll service owner had criminal charges brought against him, charged with wire fraud, tax evasion, and he had converted over $2.3 million of 50 clients' funds and filed over 160 false and fraudulent tax returns. He pled guilty to both counts, was assessed monetary damages, and sentenced to serve 37 months in prison. Now, of course, Pediatrics brought an action against PAL, which was the payroll service, and the owner, Hirsch, asserting claims for rights and violations of RICO, etc., and a default judgment was entered in their favor in the amount of $1.2 million. Now, the IRS continues down the line and sought to levy against Pediatric. They sought the taxes owed from 1999 in the first quarter of 2000. Pediatrics requested a collection due process hearing. It asserted it really shouldn't be liable for these taxes because Hirsch had embezzled its tax payments. Following the hearing, the appeals office determined that the notice was proper and they were liable to pay the taxes and interest. Pediatrics then brought an action in court seeking a redetermination of the collection action. And the court came down and said, essentially, tough luck. You hired the embezzler. You're the one who is liable for the fact that the embezzler failed to pay the liability. And if you think about it, as unfair as this may be, and as lousy as the result may be, it's basically correct. If I hire an embezzler in my firm, and the person fails to pay my utility company, I can't go to the utility company and say, well, you know, I thought he was paying you and he wasn't, so I don't think I should have to pay you for those months of electric power because I've really already paid for them. You may have already issued a payment you thought was for them, but you didn't pay for them. The same problem arose with the IRS. Now, Pediatrics attempted to claim that because the government had charged him with embezzlement, that therefore the government should be somehow foreclosed from coming after them. The court didn't go along with that one either. The court made it clear that reliance on an agent is not reasonable cause to escape liability here. You cannot get around the excuse to pay taxes merely because you're using a third party. Obviously, you can't get around it for an employee, and the court held that this was similar to an employee arrangement in this regard, and you still can't get around your liability. The embezzlement is not sufficient to stop the liability from accruing. Now, the question becomes, well, what do you do? Clients use payroll services. Many of us recommend clients use payroll services. But how do you protect yourself if you're a client from this problem? Well, the IRS and Social Security have a few recommendations in their article, and there probably are a couple of other things you should consider. The IRS suggests that the address of record for the payroll account should remain with the employer. Now, note in Pediatric's case, it appears it did. That didn't help, but at least you would get notices. The payroll service may suggest changing the address of record to them, so therefore they would get the notices and the client just wouldn't be bothered. Tell the client this is an area where you need to be bothered. If there are notices coming from the IRS, you need to know them. They may be your first indication of a major problem. The IRS suggests you ask if the provider has a fiduciary bond in place. I would add, maybe asking isn't quite going far enough. Presuming someone like the gentleman in the Pediatrics case was willing to embezzle from you, I suggest they'll be just as willing to lie when asked if they have a bond if nobody's looking to make sure. So I think maybe verification, but nevertheless, a bonded entity is very useful and will at least provide you some protection if it does turn out that the funds are taken. The IRS also suggests that you ask the payroll service to use EFTPS, the client's own EFTPS account, for deposits of payroll taxes. The IRS will allow you to designate, basically you can allow a third party to make the EFTPS payments for you, And the IRS points out that if you do that, you can go back and verify the actual payments were made. That is a case, the hitch being that in many cases, the payroll services don't tend to want to work this way. So you may have a little more sticking point there. Finally, I think it's very important that you do some background checking on any payroll provider. All it takes for somebody to become a payroll service, essentially, is to set up their shingle tomorrow morning. So anyone can come by, and your clients have to understand that a payroll service is going to have a couple of things. Number one, it's probably going to have access to a lot of your money. Very, very detailed and hands-on access to your money going through it. As Pediatrics Associates discovered, sometimes that money doesn't go where you think it should. That could be a problem. Secondly, you're going to be giving that entity all kinds of highly sensitive personal information on your employees, and I would point out to the owner of the company usually, that usually means you too. That is very useful information for identity theft. If the company itself is a fly-by-night outfit or simply exists to collect and do whatever they wish, but basically make money ways other than selling payroll services, they could very well take and sell off some of that information as well. So you need to do some background checking on the payroll services. It's okay to use a payroll service that's not a large national publicly held company. That's not the issue. But the issue is you should have some idea about the relative stability, the background, who's running it, and what's going on, and don't just pick the payroll service by the fact that this was the cheapest one. Somebody who only wants the money to embezzle it from you probably will give you a very cheap cost on processing the payroll. It may not be very cheap once you get done. Now, as noted, this is Tax Update for Saturday, March the 18th, 2006. We're coming all the way through tax season now. It's beginning to get fun and interesting for most of us who do the compliance work. So hopefully you're all keeping your heads above water, and hopefully everybody is taking a breath at least once a day and going back and breathing the air very nicely and deciding to relax and just take a minor break between. It gets difficult this time of year. The Tax Update podcast is sponsored by Limeburg Information Services on the web at www.limeburgservices.com. You can go check them out for their materials. This, again, has been Tax Update for Saturday, March the 18th, 2006.